What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! In the 1980s, Masters of the Universe, which was a proven franchise, decided to take chances with a new approach. The result was She-Ra and the Princesses of Power, with an attempt to capture a new market demographic. One of the characters used to speak to a different consumer was Glimmer, a princess who starts her character arc very happy with good intentions, but eventually falls into a depth of sadness, fearing she'll never regain the passion she once had. But once she relinquishes her place in the kingdom, she finds that ecstatic joy again. In 1994, Roadrunner Records wanted to expand their dominance of the music market and release the debut album by Kevin Salem, both parties taking a chance with this new approach, but also excited at the possibilities. But by the time 1996 had come around, that same optimism was absent. But with Kevin's sophomore effort, he attempted to make the best of a remaining glimmer of hope. This week on Meep Meep, Season 3 continues with the 1996 final release for Kevin Salem on Roadrunner Records, Glimmer. Welcome to Meep Meep, the Roadrunner podcast, where we go through the albums of Roadrunner Records with the artists who made them and the musicians they influence. Let's roll! What up, meepsters, and welcome to our second episode with singer and or songwriter Kevin Salem. Kevin joined me in the early days of the show, all the way back for 1994's Soma City, which is a modern triumph of Americana, so if you haven't listened to that episode yet, do it now! We'll wait for you. But for everyone else all caught up this week, we're discussing the follow-up to Soma City called Glimmer. Kevin is such a cool, interesting guy with casually incredible stories of recruiting Neil Young's guitarist, mixing the record at Steve Vai's house, and the craft of songwriting. But first, let's talk about a picture of a fish.
I can't remember the photographer's name, but I did reach out to him maybe a year ago, and I was like, I would really love to buy a copy of that photo. Like, we paid, like, that was legit. Like, they paid, like, a couple $1,000s to license the photo, but I don't have a copy of it. Like, nobody really has a copy. That's a beautiful photograph, the front cover.
Well, let's start with that then, because it's very intriguing to me, as you can imagine, that it's this kid with this fish who grows up to be on the cover of the Our Lady Peace album. Happiness is not a fish you can catch. That's not true.
That's not true.
And he's in front of this menu. I assume this is kind of like an older, you said, so this is like a famous photo or it's a well-known?
It is, and I don't think it's necessarily that old. Like, I think it's, you know, so that album was 1996. It might not have been 10 years old, that photo at the time. It's not like from the 50s or anything.
Right.
And, you know, when they asked me, like, I don't have like these ideas for, I want a picture of a guy with a fish. I just said, I like photographs. I like great photographs. And, he was brilliant. The guy that picked that out, you know, like when he showed it to me, I think it was the first and only photo he showed me, and I just loved it.
And does something about that photo say Glimmer to you, or does it reflect the spirit of the album?
I don't think so. I mean, it does because I say it does.
Okay.
You know, but it spoke to me in a way that I thought it was good art, and it was it was sort of like this picture of like some kind of classic part of New England or American life. Like, I take it it's New England because nobody else eats lobster rolls.
Right. At the top of the menu too. Like, that's the hallmark.
Yeah. Like, you don't need to look at item number two, just order number one.
Where does the title come from? Glimmer.
Like, when Soma City came out, so many people made so much of the, not negative tone, in a good, in a positive way, just that the songs reflected various sort of sad parts of life, or a certain ennui or something. And to me, I was just like, this is going to be a hopeful record, and it will have a glimmer of hope.
Okay, that makes sense.
It was meant to be more positive. I'm looking at the songs. It's a funny thing. It's probably the album that I'm least attached to. There are things that I'm really attached to on this album, but it wasn't like Soma City. It wasn't. It was work, and it was work writing it, because we were on the road the entire time. I mean, from before Soma City came out till the minute we made Glimmer, I was on the road, and the band kind of started to fall apart, because that's really hard for people to do. To me, Soma City, whether it's a special record to people, other people, it is special to me because it came so naturally, and I knew what it was when I made it. Glimmer, I didn't really know what it was when I made it. I never really planned on being a solo artist. And so it really kind of stunned me that, like, oh, now I made one record, and now I actually have to make another record. Like, this is my job all of a sudden. And it kind of surprised me.
Is it the same band on Glimmer as it is on Soma City?
It's the same drummer, the same bass player, the piano player, the same, but wasn't there. Like, it wasn't like the we were all together. And the guitar player, Todd, left and moved to California. It was the same producer, Nico Bolas, and Nico worked with Neil Young a lot, and he worked with Keith Richards on his solo record. And my thing was like, oh, if we're going to have a rhythm guitar player, let's get one of my two favorites. Let's either get Keith Richards or Pancho from Crazy Horse. So Pancho from Crazy Horse is the other guitar player on most of the record.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting, especially since how much you get compared to Neil Young.
Yeah, I know. And funnily, that's not the part of Neil Young I like, but I do love Pancho's playing. Like, I do think he is really one of the best rhythm guitar players in the world. Like, he has a thing. So he came, we made that record in rural Massachusetts at this place called Longview Farms. And Nico and I went there, I think, on Christmas Day in 1995. Or the day after Christmas. And so between Christmas and New Year's, it was just the two of us. And they like left us food in the fridge. And it was literally just the two of us on this big farm doing really nothing. And I was finishing writing. They also made this big giant chocolate chip cookie that took us a week to eat. So the band showed up right after New Year's, and Pancho came, and it was, there was like a huge blizzard, just a devastating like winter storm. And so Pancho showed up, and he, if you know Crazy Horse, he plays a gold top Les Paul, and then through an old tweed Fender amp, and he carried them both on the plane and rode from California and gets off the plane in the middle of this blizzard and shows up. And he plugged in and hit one chord, and I was like, that's the sound right there. Like, what was remarkable was he hit one chord, and I was like, wow, 80% of what you think Neil Young sounds like is actually this guy. So it was really fascinating. He was great. He was just one of us, and that was it. We just hunkered down. I think we took maybe a little longer to make this record. We might have taken a little bit more than a week. But Pancho came sort of halfway through, and once he started playing, we just re-recorded most of the stuff with him playing, and we just stood in a room and played together.
Now, this album is much more, to me, guitar driven than Soma City, and there's a ton of solos on it, but I know you're saying Pancho's, a rhythm guitarist. So do you think that was his influence? Was that the label's influence? Was it just something you wanted to do because it was a little bit different?
I think it was. It's funny because I'm just about finished making a new record, and I think at that time, like when I thought of music, I thought like there's verses, choruses, bridges, and a guitar solo in every single song. And it's kind of weird, like 25 years later, how much like guitar solos aren't really this thing that you just take for granted that they're going to be in every song. But I think particularly on this record, my sort of relationship with the job of being a lead singer has always been tenuous. So for me, the guitar solo is a chance to sing in a way that I actually like the voice I'm hearing. You know, like it is a, like hopefully it's a lyric. Like it's not gratuitous, but I like for me, it's just part of the lyric, but it's just a part of the lyric that comes, you know, from hands. And so, yeah, I'm looking. I think every single song has a guitar solo.
Well, the opening track, Run, 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 has several guitar solos. Like, I mean, you're just ripping it up on it. And it's sick. Like, I think it's awesome. And I was curious if it was even you that was playing, just because it's so much a departure from the leads that are on Soma City.
So it is me, and it's funny because that song was recorded at a much slower tempo with a different lyric. And so when we left Longview Farms, I'm trying to remember the order of how we did it. So initially it was recorded because I knew we weren't going to finish at Longview Farms. I had bought an 8-track thing so that I could like do some stuff at home. Like I was like, oh, if I need to add a harmonica and no use, you know, getting a studio, I'll just do it at my house. And we cut that song and it was called something else. And I took it home and I played it at its slow tempo at this other song, at different chords and everything. And I thought, I don't really like this song. And so I sped the tape way up and just listened to the drums. And we went back and we cut to the sped up drums, this new song. And it's amazing because the drums are so deep, but that's them even sped up. So they're even actually deeper, like lower pitched in real life. But yeah, the song was initially, that drum track was initially for a whole other song.
So you didn't even re-record the drums. You used the same drum track and just sped it up?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's pretty cool. Is that a common thing? I feel like it's not.
I've never done it before or
Okay,
since.
I was gonna say, like, you're kind of breezing through that. Like, that's just like a casual thing that people do. But that's incredible. Well, that's cool that you were able to, I don't want to say salvage, but that you were able to see the potential of the song and still be able to do stuff with it.
Yeah, like I think in some ways, like I'm trying to remember now how this all came together. I remember what the song was called before. It was called like whatever it was called. The line in the chorus was something about how a dam was going to break. Whatever. That's why I didn't like it. I think the lyrics. A lot of these lyrics were written really quickly too. And I'll be honest. It's like I can go through these songs and some of them, honestly, to me, were sort of me writing a lyric to a song that didn't really have a lyric. And that's kind of what I did between Christmas and New Year's. But Run, 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 yeah, the lyric was written after the song was recorded. Sleep was actually written. I had a meeting with some publisher and they were like, they had a big board behind them with like all these people who were looking for songs. And Tina Turner's name was on it. Because he was like, who would you write songs for if you could write songs for anyone? I was like, I don't know. And I looked up on his board and Tina Turner's name was there. I was like, I'll write a song about Ike beating the shit out of Tina Turner. And so that's how I wrote Sleep.
Wow. That's a dark and interesting influence. And Sleep, a big part of that song is that it has Cherie Knight.
Yeah, and I love her. And she, because I had done, I had recorded some songs with her for Warner Brothers in between Soma City and Glimmer. And I was in that band Blood Oranges just for a very brief period of time
Oh, wow.
After I left Dump Truck and before I moved to New York. And I love Sherry. I haven't spoken to her in ages, but man, she is so good. And you should hear the stuff we recorded that was never released. So good. She's just brilliant. And so she, you know, became a friend, like a closer friend. We were in a band together, so we were friends. But yeah, we got pretty close. And there's a lot of interesting, I'm looking at it and trying to remember who all, like, there's a lot of extra backing singers. A lot of friends came in and sang.
Damned has Mark Christensen from Thirst.
Yes. And I played on their record. And he's the only one that he was the only guy I knew that could hit the notes that high. I really like that song. Like, that's one of the songs from this record that I still feel a little close to. Like, I like what it is. A lot of this, like, Soma City was just like, this is the core of what I do. You know, there's no, like, I wasn't thinking about being any one thing or another. It just felt like this is like the center of what I do. This record, like, there were things that I kind of wanted to do that weren't really, you know, like, Damned wasn't really typical of, you know, anything. That's like me thinking about the Beatles or something, you know. When I look at this record, I'm like, oh, if I had just worked a little harder on a couple elements of these songs. So, and I don't like to do that. You know, for me, like, the record's out there and it's for everybody else in the world now. But when I hear it, I'm like, a song like Always, I actually really love the track. And I really almost love the song, but I'm like, if I were writing that lyric now, I could probably write it better. You know, and it, like, Destructible, it's interesting. Was really like, that was like a platform to use Pancho to do what Pancho really does well, that kind of rhythm guitar.
And that was kind of like a jam, right? Destructible, wasn't that just like a
Yeah, it was.
improv?
And there's some really cool stuff left over from that record. Like, somewhere in my studio, I have a live recording of us playing with Pancho and the whole band, and it's outrageous. It's so rock and roll and loud and destructive, you know?
Well, that's what I do like about this album versus Soma City. I mean, I like Soma City more, so I'm not trying to convince you otherwise,
You
but
know.
at the same time, there's a lot of things about Glimmer that I like that I think that you excel at that I would love to hear more of. You know, a song like Underneath, where it's like almost like a like Helmet or something, you know, it's like pretty heavy and like almost grunge influenced. I would love to hear like an album of you doing songs like that. That song's incredible.
And I thank you, and I love that song, and I really you know, for me, one of the things I think about when I think about songwriting, and one of the things I tell, if I'm, you know, when I work with like young songwriters, is like, if you can make a like a meaningful lyric in your loudest, hardest, fastest song, I think that's like a real victory, because most people tend to think of their, like, you know, up tempo stuff as like, it's more fun and it's like, it's rocking, and you know, it doesn't really need to be, you know, a deep or meaningful lyric. And then you listen to their like slowest song and it's like, wow, that lyric really got a lot of attention. And I really like that Underneath has some lyrics that a lot of people would find them more at home in like a slower, sadder song. But I really like that marriage of, you know, the loudest, fastest song. I also like, you know, that David Mansfield, who's one of my favorite musicians on earth. He plays pedal steel on that, Sleep, and on Trouble. I love that he's all over that. And yeah, I really like that track, and I like the way it sounds too.
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at rootsmusicrambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
Well, I remember when we were talking about Soma City, you were saying that, you know, the thing about going to Glimmer is that you knew what was going to happen to you. That's like the phrase that I remember you saying, like, you know what's going to happen to you. So I almost feel like when I'm listening to this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it almost sounds like kind of not halfway through the album, maybe two-thirds of the way through the album, you have resolve that you have been defeated by the record industry. You know what I mean? Like the first like eight songs or so are kind of driving and they're harder rocking. Not that, you know, anything's heavy metal or anything like that, but you know, certainly Underneath is damn close. And then the last kind of third of it sounds almost like you were like, all right, well, I have to finish this record and I'm kind of like dejected about it. Is that fair to say, or am I?
You know, I think that's actually pretty fair to say, because for me, it's the whole vibe around that moment was, first of all, I was exhausted. You know, it was like like I said, I never really planned on being a lead singer. Dealing with a record company was difficult, especially at that time, me dealing specifically with that record company. It was a difficult relationship already. And, you know, as I'm looking at the list of songs, and I'm like, some of those songs I really, really fucking like. But it did feel like I was sort of servicing some expectations people had. And that's totally on me. It wasn't like people had expectations. Again, it just all really relates to never having planned on being the lead singer in a band. So I had to find like new players. And so everything got harder. And you only make your first record one time, you know, and I've heard people describe it as like you have, however old you are, you have your whole life to get ready for your first record. And then you have a couple of months to get ready for your second record. And that did take me by surprise. And I think I was also unraveling a little bit personally from exhaustion, from relationship that ended and having to find a new band and really just, you know, the whole thing was, it was a more difficult record. I think my mantra at the time was like, second records are such a bitch. Like Soma City could not have been easier. It was like walking on air the whole time. Like everybody was buoyant, happy, energized for every minute of it. This just, it just took work. And there are things that for me, number seven, I wouldn't even put it on the album if I was making it on the album. On the other hand, there's stuff like All on Trial, which I actually really like, but it's probably the weirdest song on the record. Like if you listen to the lyric, Trouble is a song that is like, I actually really love that song and I love the recording of it. And I love Mansfield's solo, but you can actually hear like me following his beautiful pedal steel solo and being too reverent and not, you know, as you said, like maybe you would call it defeated, but it, you know, there's a time like when I would have heard David Mansfield play that beautiful solo and I would have stepped up and been like, I'm going to fucking play a better solo, no matter how good you are. And I just really wasn't that at that time. And I just was a little less sure about things. You know, there's like some of its execution. I'm very hard on this record. I am super critical of this record, far more critical than I really should be. You know, but this is the only thing I've ever done in my life where I can really like pick it apart in a visceral way. Like I remember how I felt. Like I remember, you know, when it came time to mix it, I don't care who mixes it, but it has to be mixed on this very specific kind of console. So we mixed it in Steve Vai's living room. I mean, this is fucking weird.
Is Steve Vai there?
Yeah, he would leave the house every morning and just to be out of our way.
Well, can you tell me how that ends up being the case? Because you said it very, you keep on saying these things that are insane very casually. Like, okay, so how do you end up mixing it at Steve Vai's living room? Tell me about
that. So I was like, I don't know whether I was just being like an asshole. But so I grew up, my favorite studio had this old API console in it, you know, from the, you know, early 70s. They're amazing sounding consoles. I actually had one in my own studio for a while. I sold it to David Gray, but I was like, I want it mixed on this console. I don't care who mixes it. Matt Wallace, who had just done Don't Tell a Soul, the Replacements record. So he was going to mix it. And he was like, I found the console you like. It's in Steve Vai's living room. I was like, okay, we're going to mix it at Steve Vai's house. So every morning we would wake up and we would drive to the Hollywood Hills, and every morning Steve Vai or his wife, or he had a kid, I think, they would like leave the house so that like we could be in their living room mixing a fucking record on this gigantic console.
And this guy just had a relationship with Steve Vai where he could say, hey, can you please leave your house so this guy can come mix it?
Nope, not even. He had a manager who was given the task of like, find one of these consoles in Los Angeles so that you can afford the studio space that you can mix it. And that was what he found. So I don't think I really knew. I mean, I knew that Steve Vai was like a, but I was like, well, I don't even know. I wouldn't know what to say to Steve Vai. Like, I would know what to say to Joe Strummer. You know, I mean, like, I would know what to say to David Crosby. I would know what to say to like all kinds of people, but like Steve Vai, I was like, I don't know. Like, hey, dude, I like the handle on your guitar, because he played those guitars with the funny handles. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, coming from the world that I came from.
Well, speaking of mixing the album, a distinction that I heard on this record than, you know, the thing that you described about Soma City is that it was all kind of recorded in a way that when it was mixed, you know, when you're raising the volume on or the levels on one thing, it's really like raising it on another because it's kind of like in this live room. Whereas on Glimmer, you can distinctly hear like the different guitar parts and different, you know, headphones and things like that. So was that a deliberate choice to kind of do something a little different?
You know, mostly it was that we had Pancho, who just does what Pancho does. Like, that's his thing, like that choppy, beautiful, grindy, Neil Young-ish kind of rhythm guitar. The thing that you think is Neil Young. And Matt Cullen, who did some touring with us at the end of Soma City's tour, overdubbed on a couple things. But really, it was and it was intentional, and it was fun for Nico and I to spend time alone together, like layering guitars on. And I do love to do that. And I don't really do it nowadays. Like when I record, I say this thing that like, you get better at making records when you get bored with making records. And right now, if I'm making a record, I'm not like, my head is exploding with ideas for guitars. You know, now I'm kind of like, I don't know. I got 15 minutes. Let's see if we can make something happen, you know? And that's exciting to me. But here, like we did add some layers, and like the weird high strung acoustic guitar on Underneath, the loudest song on the record, but played with like a torn matchbook, like hammered on it to add that little high pitched thing that you hear in there.
I was going
to
ask you, I was like, is there like a keyboard on this thing? Like, it sounds crazy. That kind of like tubey, I don't know, even know how to describe it, but I guess you just kind of.
Yeah. It's like the thin strings from a 12 string played with like a matchbook. So it's a guitar an octave higher and, just that, you know.
And that's even cooler because, like I said before, that song is so heavy compared to everything else, but to have that little kind of, you know, texture to it kind of softens it a little bit in a good way.
Yeah, and I actually love doing that kind of stuff. Like, it was super intentional. Like, here is this song that, like, people will listen to it and they will think of, you know, the things that you will think of when you hear a song like that. But one thing they won't think of is a pedal steel playing on it. So it was really like, I love doing that. Like, just sort of, you know, if you're going to be happy hearing a bunch of grinding guitars, you're going to have to deal with the pedal steel. Or if you think pedal steel just belongs on, you know, a song like Trouble because you like Americana, I'm going to use it here. And I really like that kind of stuff.
And Underneath ends up being the single for the album. So is that when you're making that song, are you thinking that too? Like, oh, this can be the single. This is kind of the harder edge stuff that maybe Roadrunner's looking for from me anyway.
I don't think I ever think in those terms, but I do remember Nico and I did some of the last overdubs and did some mixing at the Hit Factory, which is now closed, had this very small room that had a console in it that belonged to the guy that produced Thriller, the Michael Jackson record. And it was just that console and then a little closet off to the side where you could stick a guitar amp or you could go sing. And I just remember Nico and I, when we're working together, we work very loud. And I just remember my publisher, because I had a publishing deal with Warner Chappell at the time, and she walked into the studio and that was just blasting through these massive speakers. And she just goes, where the fuck did that come from? And I was like, that's going to be a single. You know, like I knew then that like, if that was her reaction. But I think I thought, to the extent that I think about those things, I know that when we were cutting Innocence and we put like all these layers of jangly guitars on, I remember Nico saying, I've only ever had this feeling one other time, you know, and that was when I was cutting The Boys of Summer. Like in my mind, that was what a single sounded like, I guess. I don't think it ever got much attention outside of, you know, the True Believers Club, the hardcore fans, but and I think underneath, like, the thing about a song like that is that's where it really matters that I'm Kevin Salem instead of, you know, a band. Like, I just think it doesn't compute for people to hear something like that. And then who's it by? It's by a guy called Kevin. You know, like, it just, I think in some ways, like, that was like the struggle of the, in a lot of ways, it's really the, like, part of the conundrum of my entire career. Like, I hated being called a singer-songwriter then, but I don't know, what else do you call somebody that uses their own name? You know, I remember doing interviews, and they were like, I remember doing an interview with a French radio station, and they were like, you know, what makes you a singer-songwriter? Because in that culture, that's like a huge compliment. In 1996, in sort of American commercial music culture, singer-songwriter was like, it's like, you, like, it was like, what makes, you know, what makes you such a loser? They may as well have just put it that way, you know, like, why are you such a loser? Whereas in France, it was like, it's important to be a singer-songwriter. You know, that was a struggle. I think it was probably a struggle for Roadrunner too. I think marketing something that sounds like that by a dude called Kevin just didn't ever compute to anybody. And like, we would open for bands, you know, like, we would play with, you know, 311, and it'd be like, 311, opening band, Kevin Salem. It's like,
now, this being the second record, historically, from everyone I talk to, the second record is when Roadrunner's like, hey, we have some notes. So what kind of what kind of influence, I don't want to say influence, but what kind of commentary did they have while you were making this record?
That's a good question. They didn't really have much commentary, because I still think at this point, there was Monty who, understood, like, that kick drum's got to be like super punchy. And I was like, okay, that's somebody, that's a job that somebody does. They turn a knob and that's, it makes it that way. You know, there was Howie, who I told you, Howie Abrams, who was always like the guy, like, I would just go to his desk and be like, oh my God, I'm having such a fucking hard time navigating all this. Can you help me figure this fucking place out? You know, there was like, you know, Doug, who was like, we got to move units or whatever, you know? And, you know, and there was Jeff, who like understood it musically and also understood the aesthetic that, like, this is the kind of music where you don't like go in there with a list of demands from an artist. You kind of let them do their thing. And then there was Sue Marcus, who was really, there were other marketing people, but like, she just looked at it as like, I will market the person, you know? So nobody really had, I don't remember anybody telling me, like, their thing was like, we need a big mixer, you know, that was like, that was their sort of solution. But I think that's because there wasn't really A&R per se, in that there was the artist part, but the repertoire part, there wasn't anybody being like, this needs a bigger chorus, or, you know, all that stuff that you would say. In some ways, I don't know how I would respond to that. I would hope I would respond to it in an adult way and maybe make it better. You know, like I said, the weird ones are the ones that stick out. And when I, like, when I played live, the songs people ask for all the time are Innocence and Chemical Night Train. And Run, Run, Run is probably a song I play it every time I play live. You know, I enjoy playing it by myself. I enjoy playing it with the band. And I really love that kind of guitar soloing where it's just like, it's, you know, here's 32 measures, just move from motif to motif and have fun and make it like, give it a dynamic arc, you know?
Yeah, tell me more about Chemical Night Train. First of all, what is a Chemical Night Train? Is this like Snowpiercer or something? What's going on?
It's, you know what it is? It's kind of like, I think lyrics are, some lyrics tell a story. I don't do that. And if I were to try, I would do it terribly. Like Steve Earle and Freddie Johnston do that really well. Like to me, I love lyrics that are just like a collection of words that have sort of cultural meaning, cultural cachet. And, you know, I was still thinking quite a bit about drugs, even though I was clean, sober for a while by the time we made this record, but I'm still thinking about the culture and the sadness of like, you know, having drug friends. And that's all. It's just a collection of words that mean, that sort of hover around that theme. And I like that song, you know, I'm okay with that song.
Yeah. I love that song. The first five songs I think are pretty flawless, and there's other ones that I like I love Sleep and All on Trial, but you know, they're a little bit more, slower paced, you know, for sure.
And they're those are definitely what you would call album cuts.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, sort of intentionally, like, I will maintain that All on Trial is one of the weirdest, like for me, just knowing what was intentional about it.
Did you get dropped from Roadrunner, or you got out of your contract?
I got dropped. You know, that's a little bit chicken and egg-ish. I mean, one of the things that happened was there was a lot of attention from the European press, and I had a booking agent, like a really good one in Germany. It's like someone, you know, was like, I want to be your booking agent. And here's this tour. And he booked a tour. And I was like, this. So after we made this, we were supposed to go to Europe and do this pretty extensive tour. And one day my manager was like, we're not going to Europe. I was like, why? And he was like, well, your agent called the label and they said, we have no intention of supporting this tour. And that really pissed me off. It pissed me off, but more than pissing me off, it actually was, it hurt, because I understand the amount of money that a company like Roadrunner and effort that they spend, but it's nothing compared to the amount of money and effort I spent. and my band, you know, these dedicated dudes who, you know, one of them, you know, I'd say Dave Dunton, his marriage may never have been the same after that. You know, I mean, for me, like my engagement got broken off, you know. For Todd, it was like, if I don't leave this band, I'm going to lose my relationship. You know, like it just, this is, it's fun and it's awesome, but it will upend every other part of your life, you know? And I was just like, man, I just spent a whole year doing this, and like a guy I don't even know in Germany is like relaying the news to me that my record company said, quote, we have no intention of supporting this tour. And so there, you know, it was like, well, we're $16,000 short, so we can't go. And that's like a big part of the world. And for somebody that does what I do, that's probably a bigger part of the world than Illinois. You know what I mean? Like to, like when I finally went to Italy and played shows a couple years ago, the audience were there clearly waiting since Soma City. Like that's what it was based on. And I was like, if we'd only gone at the time, you know, I would have a career there. And like, so when I need money, you know, I mean, it's my fucking job. So, you know, it was a tense relationship, and I was an asshole. right? Like I, you know, I, cause I just had, it's funny, like how many times between myself and my friends, I have learned the lesson that like, when you want your label to drop you, usually it's for a good reason. When it finally happens, you're just kind of like, oh, fuck. Now what, you know? So it, you know, like I got dropped and I immediately, you know, got it. I had a new manager and I did, you know, all kinds of showcases and labels would come out and they'd be like, oh, it's almost what I like, but not exactly. And you know what I mean? And it was just like, if like, you know, being on like a label that was like a sort of a bullying, you know, like wanted to make a point, both of us, of like, I don't give a shit what you have to say to the other. Like if that's the worst thing, the second worst thing is like hearing from people, I like it, but I'm not going to sign it. Or like even sitting in an office at Atlantic Records, when you know, like, you know, like however bad it was between me and Roadrunner, it was going to be worse between, you know, me and Atlantic.
So after this album, you release Ecstatic a few years later.
Yeah.
And I'm a big Liz Phair fan. Are you familiar with Liz Phair?
Of course you are. Yeah.
So a few years ago, at this point, it's probably like 10 years ago, she put out an album called Fun Style. Do you know this album? And that's what Ecstatic is to me. It's the Kevin Salem Fun Style, where you're just like doing all sorts of crazy shit. And I need you to tell me about a little bit about if Ecstatic is a result of Glimmer in any way, like if they're any way connected, in the sense that you just wanted to do all sorts of different things that you didn't get, you didn't feel like maybe you were able to do trapped in this, you know, rock world.
That is an excellent question, actually. And it's not an excellent question because I've ever thought about it before. It's an excellent question because there actually is an answer. And I would say that it is absolutely not related to Glimmer at all. And I would say it's probably not related to Soma City. I think it was really, Ecstatic was where the idea that I was a band stopped. Even though the people I made Ecstatic with, Rich Mercurio, Scott Yoder, who was on all the records, Rob Arthur, but particularly Rich and Rob, we were learning things together. And so Ecstatic, I mean, Rob Arthur, who just does so many different things on Ecstatic, is like a virtuoso. Like he's, you know, brilliant piano and B3 player, but also like if you hand him a trombone, he's going to do cool shit. So I never really had that before. That was really cool. You know, I never really cared much for programming things before, but I was working by myself and it was like, it just made a certain amount of sense. Professionally, it made sense to learn how to do this stuff. And then as an artist, it made sense to use the stuff I was learning to do. And we were kind of learning together, all of us. The thing about Ecstatic is that no two people ever played any of those songs in the same room at the same time in the recording of that record. I mean, it was made one track at a time, which is unique. Now, the album I'm almost finished making now, to me, is actually the logical follow-up to Soma City. Like, it feels super, just like it just popped out. And as much as it could be, we, you know, some of it was recorded like late at night in a room all together, and it's not fussy in terms of like the singing, and Soma City was just, I just sang the songs. It wasn't really, and I think honestly, if I had to say something about Glimmer that I regret, it's that I really tried to be a better singer, when what I really should have done was just been a more honest singer. because I thought on Soma City, whatever else you think of the vocals, I promised you I wasn't trying for anything. Again, still a little bit self-conscious, like Glimmer, but I think producing other singers so much over the last, 20 years has really like beaten the part out of me that is like, try harder. Cause every day I'm like, don't try so hard. Like, you're trying too hard. You sound like you're trying. Like, that's something I say 100 times on every record I make, no matter how great the singer is. Like, I can hear you trying, and I've learned that just isn't helpful.
Well, I know that there's a lot of things, like you even mentioned yourself, that you could tear this record apart, but what is something that you're really proud of that you look back on and you do appreciate about Glimmer?
The first thing I'll say is that it got made, because there's a thing about music, right? Like, it's people have written volumes and artists have spoken volumes about the dichotomy of art and craft, right? Like, oh, she's an artist, or he's a craftsman. You know what I mean? Like, John Lennon, artist. Paul McCartney, craftsman. It's a weird dichotomy, and it's not really a real thing. What I will say is that what you hope for when you walk into a recording studio is Soma City. Like, everything comes out, it's natural, it's easy. It comes from the most honest place, and it comes out in the most unpretentious way. Unfortunately, that doesn't often happen. So you need like a technical gear to slip into. Like, some days it's kind of like, I don't know, man. I would love to like have 2 weeks to decide whether, you know, like the famous story about Yesterday, the Beatles song of like, I'll use a different Beatles example, the song Oh Darlin', with its like legendary, awesome vocal. And McCartney just went in and sang the song every day until he got the take he wanted. Like, we don't really have, that's like all art. That's like, just keep, man, when you're feeling it, it'll be great. Glimmer had to be made. Like, it just like, it was like, this is your job. You got to make it. You're under a contract to make it. The record company's expecting it. And they're, by the way, going to put a lot of effort into making you successful. And it's due now. It's like, it's 2021 now, and people make records every 5 years. It's bad strategy. But in 1996, you made a record every year. Like, that was how you did it. So it had to be made. So just that I was able to get enough art in it for me to feel like it's a good album, but I know how much of it was made sort of from that technical place, from like, I just, I need a rhyme for the word innocence, So the first thing is that it got made. Now, like, there's other things that I really love about this record. I feel like even though some of them miss slightly, like if I had been a better songwriter, I would have known, like, I'm not really done writing this yet. I still have a little work to do. But what is this? Like, what I have always thought about this record is that, like, the fulfillment of my other records, the fulfillment of the vision is better. But I think the seed of what is in Glimmer, I would never go back and re-record an album. But I could make this one a lot better. And I know that the seed of it is really strong. Like, it's a thoughtful record. It was a thing. And in some ways, I guess I'll add that to things I like. Like, I know that it doesn't all succeed, but there are places like Destructible where I was reaching for something, where like always I was reaching for something like that beautiful, dreamy sort of English pop that is kind of lush and romantic, but it's just not what I do. But I wanted to reach for it. I tried, and there it is. And it's close, and the seed of it is right. Underneath is like it's a definite style of music, especially at that time. And I felt like I reached for it and I got it, and it felt natural, And I think in some ways, when you have, 8 or 9 days to make a record where you're reaching for stuff, I think it's inevitable that you're going to get some of it. Like, on the other hand, if I look at Ecstatic, I reached for a lot of stuff, but I had a lot of time. So I also got it, like, I could keep reaching until I felt satisfied.
Thanks to Kevin Salem for the stories and the songs. You can check out this album, Glimmer, as well as Soma City and Ecstatic, all on streaming services, including kevinsalem.bandcamp.com, if you want to toss a nickel to your Witcher, or whatever people said a lot when that show came out. Hey, want to toss me a nickel? Well, you can have your nickel back and just tell someone about the show and that great Nickelback joke I just made while joining me every week for an all-new episode. My name is Ryan Rainbow, this is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best I could come up with. Bye!